Brenson v. Motorola. Mr. Ellis.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This case, for the second time before you, now involves two public policy questions that we believe that the court should address in order to give effect to the intent of Congress in this matter, in the matter of FMLA. First is whether or not James Brenison can recover his economic losses after he suffered retaliatory, postscriptive retaliation. He exercised his rights. He came back to work, as was his right. And then at that point on, we believe the facts would show that a pattern emerged in which he was pulled out of his position, reprimanded repeatedly, and at last resort actually was accused of some kind of discrimination against other employees. This was a man who had GERD, who was under psychiatric care and was in a fragile condition, which his employers and supervisors were aware of. He eventually had to leave work because of his illness, and at that point, and from that point on, he has not been able to work. We propose to introduce medical evidence, not as the district court and Motorola would ask you to believe, for the purposes of establishing a personal injury. Rather, that medical evidence was intended to establish a causation between the conduct of Motorola, the retaliatory, postscriptive conduct of Motorola, and the illness that prevents him from working, bringing this clearly within the ambit of 2615, and then damages would flow under 2617. Those damages are economic. Nobody was seeking damages for pain and suffering, or anything that would be viewed in the neighbor of tort damages. The damages strictly were lost wages, lost benefits, and future wages. The second public policy issue is a very interesting one. Anna Lina Weaver, we litigated on her behalf. Again, this was a postscriptive action of Anna Lina Weaver. This court held that she did have a sufficient case to survive summary judgment, reversed the district court's initial finding about summary judgment. We went back down. We continued to litigate on behalf of Anna. Basically, when the case is ready for trial, Motorola tenders to her all of her damages and liquidated damages. She was only seeking from the very beginning $1,800 for unpaid tuition reimbursement. Motorola tenders to her $3,600 and says, that's it. That put us in a very delicate situation as her lawyers. In fact, we believe it was a conflict situation. Basically, our client now had all of her actual economic damages in her pocket. Not her full damages, just her economic damages, because amongst the damages we are entitled to seek under 2617 are attorney's fees. Motorola then argues, and so we were in a position where we had to accept the money. Our client otherwise would have been faced the risk of maybe not getting anything after trial.
That's the problem. You cash the check and...
Your Honor, absolutely. And that is a dilemma. But it's a dilemma that we are placed in. You know, and think about it from a future that lawyers, the other side now can put lawyers representing employment plaintiffs in that untenuous position by tendering them the full economic damages of their client, thereby saying you have recovered in full.
But my recollection is that's not the only, I mean, under this statute, that's not the only time this happens. Lawyers sometimes counsel, you have to counsel their clients that you take the money and that's the end of the case.
Sometimes they do, but that still does, that's blind, that's putting blinders on the problem, that the conflict that it creates between the attorney and client. Why should plaintiff's lawyers in that situation be put in a conflict situation with their client? And it's done intentionally in order to trigger something. Now, that's the problem. Now, you know, if this court says, and I'm willing, we accepted this risk when we did this, all right, if that's the case, then we have to reject it. If that's the instruction that this court is going to give us in the future, then I guess myself and other plaintiff's lawyers will have to live with that, and we'll have to sit back and reject it.
Won't you have to address the law? Why is this a problem for the courts?
Well, that's what the district court said also. Is it a question for the legislature?
Yeah, and that's what I'm asking. They passed the law. All we're doing is ruling that.
Well, the law does not say, as the district court said, that it has to be a judgment.
That's what it says.
Except that the statute doesn't actually say a condition precedent to it is a judgment.
It says it's got to be, if you get a judgment, you get attorney's fees. You don't get
well,
a judgment.
No,
get
actually,
fees.
Judge, respectfully, it says the court in such an action shall, in addition to any judgment, okay? Is that to be read in a way that is a condition, a judgment is condition preceding to recovering any damages?
In addition to any judgment. Judgment is the first thing.
Well, I respect.
No judgment.
Respectfully,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I understand. I didn't expect you to agree with me. I just. I like to hear myself talk.
No, I don't think that it's right to say that that there has to be a condition precedent to be a judgment to get attorney's fees. That in effect defeats the intent of Congress.
Congress knows how to say things very clearly.
Okay.
They didn't say what you think they said.
I agree, Judge. But Congress did leave enforcement of this statute to private counsel. They did not delegate this to the Department of Labor or anyone else. They delegated it to private counsel.
Great.
And if we are now going to be faced with this in the future, and the court says that I should have rejected it, then we'll live with it. Except that at that point, at that moment, we really had no choice. We were only arguing about $3,600. We're going to end up arguing 10, 20 times that amount for attorney's fees later on. We could have rejected it, except that our client is in the position of saying, what do we do? Now we turn back to Brenizon. Brenizon basically exercised all 12 weeks of his leave. In the King case, Your Honor wrote an exhaustive decision differentiating between prescriptive and proscriptive remedies available under the Act. Somehow or another, there's been confusion here as to what Mr. Brenizon is seeking and when he can get proscriptive relief. The hypothetical would be Betsy goes on maternity leave. She goes there for 12 weeks. On the day after her 12th week expires, she goes back to work. Under the theory posited by Motorola and the ruling of the district court, she is no longer protected because her 12 weeks have expired, so that the employer then is free to retaliate for exercising the rights. So she goes back to work, she works for 2 days, and the employer sits back and says, well, you put us in a bad way by taking 12 weeks leave, so we're going to have to let you go now that you've taken your medical leave, so ta-ta. Is that a retaliation? Absolutely. Is she protected? She ought to be, because she is being retaliated against for exercising her rights as under the Act. So the only question then is, the question really is, does retaliation have to occur within the 12-week period? If the retaliation occurs afterwards, then she ought to be protected. Now, under the court's ruling, she's no longer protected. Then the court goes on to rule, because the medical expenses are not admissible, you now can't prove any of your damages. Basically, they gutted our case by saying that all the damages here occurred after his 12 weeks have expired. He lost his wages for still unemployed. He lost his benefits. He's lost the opportunity to get front pay, none of which the Supreme Court has says are compensatory damages. These are straight economic damages that flow. Granted, this is an unusual case. It's an egregious case. The facts are really out there. But that, as the old axiom, tough facts make tough cases. And this is this has always been a tough case. This case has been litigated tooth and nail throughout the proceedings. We still haven't gotten to the point where we could go to trial, because we can't get to the point where we can get an understanding that he was retaliated against, that he's entitled to proscriptive remedies, and that he's entitled to all the damages that flow therefrom. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Okay.
Morning, Your Honors. Noah Finkel on behalf of Defendant Eppley Motorola. I'm going to address James Bernison's claims first and then Ms. Lineweaver Sweeney's claims for fees. Mr. Bernison cannot obtain damages under the FMLA associated with the loss of his job for really two reasons. And the first one, which I think distinguishes this from the Betsy hypothetical that Mr. Bell has provided, is that he has not made a claim that the termination of his employment was unlawful in any way or that it violated the FMLA. Second, he's admittedly been unable to work during the entire period for which he claims damages. So he's therefore foreclosed by two lines of cases. One, the rule in nearly all circuits that consequential damages are not available under the FMLA. And second, by this court's decision in the Franzen versus Ellis case, which is supported by a case law of other circuits as well, that a plaintiff can't obtain back pay or front pay for periods during which he's unable to work. And I think the first important thing to realize is to get a proper characterization of what Mr. Bernison's claim is. He does claim that up until February 5, 2002, that Motorola created a hostile work environment for him and harassed him because he took FMLA. This, he says, caused him anxiety and stress. That caused his medical condition to become exacerbated, which caused him to be unable to work. Ultimately, he went on a leave. His leave expired. He lost his job. Because he lost his job, he claims he lost back pay, claims he will lose front pay, and that because of this, he doesn't have employer-provided health insurance, and thus he has out-of-pocket medical expenses that, due to his exacerbated medical condition, are quite substantial. Now, to be clear, this is not the typical claim for back pay in, say, an FMLA, sorry, in a Title VII case or an ADA case, where the plaintiff says, much like in the Betsy hypothetical that Mr. Bellis gave, that the person was ready, willing, and able to work, and the employer says, I think his words were ta-ta. This isn't that kind of case. Mr. Bernison does not make a wrongful termination claim under the FMLA. His employment was terminated June 27, 2003. It's because his FMLA leave had been exhausted, and then on top of that, the additional leave that Motorola provided him pursuant to company policy had also been exhausted. And he's never challenged that in the pleadings of this case or otherwise. Nor has he brought a constructive discharge claim, where he's saying that Motorola's conduct toward him somehow made conditions so intolerable that it would force a reasonable person to be unable to work or to otherwise quit. Instead, this claim is for consequential damages that nearly every court to look at this matter has rejected. This ranges from emotional distress claims that the Sixth Circuit, Fourth Circuit, and Tenth Circuits have rejected, nominal damages that the Fourth Circuit has rejected, loss of job security claims that the 11th Circuit has suggested, rejected. And in one case, the Nero case out of the 11th Circuit, about $5,100 for out-of-pocket expenses due to a job search that were rejected. And the Sixth Circuit, in fact, in the Edgar case, that is fairly analogous to this case, involved damage for job loss in a way similar to Mr. Bernison's. That was rejected as well as other district court cases that are in our brief. Now, I believe there's four potential exceptions that come out of the authorities suggested by Mr. Bernison in his opening brief and his reply brief. First, as we've discussed, if one gets fired because they took FMLA leave, then yes, there is a claim for back pay, front pay, and all of that. We don't dispute that. Those remedies are available under the statute, but again, that's not a claim that's being made here. Ours is a couple steps removed from that. Second, as is apparent in Mr. Bernison's brief, there are several other statutes other than the FMLA on which these kind of claims are tenable. In Title VII, we wouldn't be making the argument that we're making. Under the ADA, we wouldn't make the same ones either. Compensatory damages are available. Consequential damages are available, but the FMLA remedies are distinct. The third is a case expressed particularly in plaintiff's reply. It's a Supreme Court case in Nevada versus Hibbs, which is cited for the proposition that recovery of lost wages that a plaintiff would have earned had he Daisy could have worked but was unable to because the defendant's FMLA violation does not constitute forbidden recovery of compensatory damages. We've examined that case several times and can't find that proposition in there anywhere, which leaves the best authority that plaintiff has, which is the Ninth Circuit's decision in Farrell. That's really the only contrary authority, at least potentially, to the other circuit's authority about the prohibition on consequential damages. There, the plaintiff's substantive FMLA rights were denied. This caused him to be stressed out. And that caused him to miss work, $1,100 worth of it. And this was amidst the days he was still working. And in plaintiff's reply, that case, in an opening brief as well, that case is used to support his argument. But this court shouldn't follow Farrell here for three reasons. First, Farrell missed this work while he still had FMLA leave time left. So this he hadn't used up his 12 weeks, so the claim fit under the rubric of the FMLA far easier than does Mr. Bernison's. Second, the Ninth Circuit based its ruling on the modest damages in that case being what they called easily quantifiable. And that's something that isn't shown here. This isn't a few days of work, $1,100 worth. This is nearly 10 years of back pay. It's an undetermined number of years of front pay. Both of those carry with them all sorts of thorny issues surrounding mitigation. They usually involve battle of experts and trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again had the plaintiff remained employed and are far different. Third, with all due respect to the Ninth Circuit, this easily this easily quantifiable exception doesn't find any support in the text of the statute, in any legislative history or intent that we've been able to ascertain, and is contrary to what other circuits have found on the FMLA, particularly in the Nero case out of the 11th Circuit. There, the out-of-pocket losses were easily quantifiable. They also were somewhat modest, but the 11th Circuit had no trouble in dismissing those as consequential damages that are outside of the FMLA's remedial provisions. Now, Bernison's theory is unworkable for a second.
Are you going to get to Lineweaver's case eventually?
I'm sorry?
You're going to get to this Lineweaver's case eventually?
I will.
Is there something, you're kind of close to running out of time here, and that something bothers me about that case. It seems to me, and you tell me where I'm wrong, that she wouldn't have got a nickel here without a lawyer. And a lawyer who works on the case for 8 years or something and now is out of luck. She's entitled to attorney's fees if she's the prevailing party. I understand that there was no judgment that was entered here, but it just something seems wrong about that. Does that bother you at all?
It doesn't bother me here for a couple of reasons. One is that Ms. Line River Sweeney's claims weren't a strong part of this at any point. This was a claim brought on behalf of several additional plaintiffs originally, many of whose claims have been bounced by the district court in, I believe, 2005 or 2006, much of which, with the exception of James Renison and Anna Line River Sweeney's, the dismissal of their claims was affirmed by this court in Bernice and One. This case would have been brought in some way in any event. More fundamentally, however, I believe your concerns are best directed towards the legislature, and I would direct this court.
I wish the Rule 68 would have permitted the plaintiffs here to make an offer of judgment that we will take $3,400 plus a reasonable attorney's fee not to exceed $20,000, you know, whatever, something like that. But the offer of judgment statute only works for defending claims. That's
correct, and we did not proceed under Rule 68. What we did was moot the claim, and I further note that I don't believe we put Mr. Bellis in an ethical box here. In fact, whether he accepted that...
You intentionally put him in an ethical box.
No,
but I think that there's a problem for him. This is the most that she could get, I think. Maybe it's an argument that she could get more. I don't think so. I think it's double damages. That's the most she can get. But she wouldn't have got a nickel without having had a lawyer. That's just something seems wrong about that.
Yeah, I hear your concern. I think there's a number of competing provisions that are competing values that Congress considered. There are other attorney's fee shifting statutes that are broader in this sense, where a plaintiff doesn't need to prevail. And that's not what...
She prevailed here. She just didn't get a judgment.
Well, she prevailed only to the extent with Motorola provided her with the money because this wasn't worth fighting.
All the money that she was due, she got.
That's correct.
That I don't know what the definition of prevailing party is, but that seems to fit pretty well.
Well, the definition of a prevailing party is one where a material alteration in the legal where there's a material alteration of the legal relationship between the parties.
No, if she got a judgment in this case, she'd be the prevailing party.
Precisely. Precisely. Under mootness, in the mootness doctrine, she is not that. But I would note that whether plaintiff accepted the offer or not would not have made a difference here. Under this court's precedent in Holstein, the mere offer of full relief moots the claim. So she could have rejected that claim, and we would have been standing before you in the same way right now.
I'm sorry. We have case law that says just a mere offer, whether they accept it or not?
Yes. Yes. In fact, the...
You don't have to look. Right. I have to.
It's the Holstein decision. And it quotes Rand versus Monsanto.
What happened to all the emails that indicates that's exactly what they were doing, trying to defeat Family Medical Leave Act?
The authenticity of those are hotly contested. And that has not been resolved.
How the authenticity of an email? What's?
We believe that they are doctored emails. And there's a battle of the experts that could have detained us to the price of several hundred or thousand or millions of dollars in attorney's fees had we tried the case. But we think we found a more efficient way to resolve it.
Well, I'm sure you did because that's not part of this case in any event.
Correct. There's one other argument I'd like to address on Mr. Brenison's claim, which is that a second reason why his appeal should be denied is that he admittedly was unable to work during the time period in which he's claiming damages. And under this court's decision in Franzen, that means that he is not entitled to back pay for that period. Once that period occurred, Motorola was free to terminate his employment for any lawful reason, which there's no dispute it did. And that means that Bernison no longer has any right to back pay. Now, that wouldn't, that wouldn't be the case if he claimed an unlawful discharge, but he didn't. So therefore, he has attempted two workarounds on that rule. The first is that he says that front pay, as opposed to back pay, nevertheless is available because it's equitable relief. But there are two problems we see with this backdoor argument. First, it's anomalous to us to have front pay available but not back pay due to the ban against consequential damages. Second, I'm guessing like a broken record here, but it is anomalous to have front pay in a case where the plaintiff doesn't claim that the very termination is unlawful. The next argument that Bernaysen makes is that he says Motorola shouldn't benefit when it's the one that he alleges rendered him unable to work, and therefore it shouldn't be able to benefit from its own conduct. There's no support for this theory, however, in the statute. It ends up being a form of consequential damages that invites endless analysis of causation and foreseeability and turns the FMLA into a tort-style statute, which it is not. It turns its remedies into tort-style remedies, which Congress crafted them in a way where they would not be. It allows compensation or recovery for compensation that flows immediately from the denial of FMLA rights, which this didn't, because it is only the conduct that rendered it unable to work that resulted in him ultimately being terminated. And then, moreover, the FMLA as a whole never is concerned about the cause of an injury. It is a leave statute. If you have a serious health condition, you otherwise qualify for leave, you get the leave. It doesn't matter why. That is never gone there. That's never discussed. So nowhere in the statute or in the remedies here is there room for consequential damages. Thank you.
Thank you. Else?
I thought I was getting beat before I started. I want something clear on the record, and that is Mr. Bernaysen is not seeking the consequential damages that are tort in nature. He is seeking the economic damages that are very quantifiable. He was rendered Motorola. If we go into the emails, there was a distinct pattern that Motorola management said, we are going to go after the people that exercise FMLA rights, and we are going to punish them so that people are deterred from taking FMLA in the future. So they did that. In Anna Liner Weaver's case, they denied her tuition reimbursement. In Bernaysen's case, they pulled him off the assembly line. They did all kinds of other things that rendered him sick. Now, that is exactly what 2615 says is a retaliation, is a discrimination. That is exactly what is prohibited. Employers should never be allowed to intimidate and punish employees for exercising a clear congressional right, a right granted to them, a new right, but a right granted to them by Congress. As a result, the consequence, this is how it's being framed, but that's not what we're seeking. We're not seeking damages for intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's gone. However, we are seeking the exact damages that 2617 says, lost wages, specifically. Those are economic damages. Lost benefits, provided for in the statute. Future wages, like an equitable remedy. Those are exactly, and let's make it clear, we are exactly alleging that Motorola rendered him unable to work because of their harassment. Now, going back to Anna Leinenweber, I just want to close this with we raised this with the district court, and the district court had the same comments that Your Honor had, and that is this just doesn't smell right. The district court seemed frustrated and said, we're going to leave it to the legislator. We asked the court, though, and said, you have the equitable power to do the right thing. And we appealed to the equitable power of the court. So we believe that the court still had the equity available and the authority inherent in its equitable powers to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. We move forward.